Les colloques du Collège de France.
Good, welcome back from lunch. We're going to get started in the afternoon session. My name is Nick Shea and I'm chairing the three talks this afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be able to welcome our afternoon's first speaker, Karen Lewis. You'll have just finished lunch with the notion of pseudo-entity representations and pseudo-links resonating, and now we've got more pseudo because Karen's going to tell us about pseudo-singular thought and talk. Over to Karen.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that introduction, and thank you so much for inviting me here today. I'm afraid I might use pseudo in a different way from Hans, so it's going to be extra confusing, but maybe that's some things that we can work out over the course of the talk. Okay. I want to start out by giving you a little bit of background about the way I think of things that I think both explains why I was motivated to think about these questions that I'm thinking about in the talk, and also why I implement things the way I do. Before I say that, I want to just say none of the broader project that I'm engaged with is, you know, you don't have to take that on board to take on board a lot of what I say in the talk today, but I want to give a little bit of context. So in previous work, I argue for a particular view of discourse dynamics, one that rejects a dynamic semantics and has instead a quite traditional truth conditional static semantics. And I tend to think of the dynamics of discourse, that is, the updating of conversational contexts and the tracking of things in the conversational context, as a matter of pragmatic reasoning. On my view, my preferred view, contexts track discourse reference in addition to truth conditional information. So it's very common to think of a dynamic pragmatics as one that, following, say, the seminal work of Robert Stalnecker, just includes truth conditional information. But I've argued that we can include discourse information like discourse reference. And of course, like in any kind of dynamic pragmatic theory, I think of there being a two-way interaction, and as in dynamic semantics, there's a two-way interaction between context and content. But in a dynamic pragmatic theory, it's really that the pragmatics can affect interpretation in affecting the interpretation of context sensitivity. And then we employ pragmatic reasoning based on what speakers do in a discourse to update the conversational context for things like the common ground or the discourse reference. So this really motivated me to be interested in the question of whether we can ground the notion of a discourse referent in that of a mental file. And the reason I was particularly interested, I'm not the first one to be interested in the idea of grounding the notion of a discourse referent. Since Kartunen first came up with them, they've been feared to be metaphysically mysterious. There's many people who have tried to ground the notion or have wanted to ground the notion. I think it's particularly important for someone who's thinking about a dynamic pragmatics to try to ground the notion of a discourse referent. Because if you're working within a dynamic semantic framework, you might be more or less happy with thinking that, oh, discourse reference are just a theoretical tool that we use in the course of semantic interpretation. Some people are happy with that, some people are not. But if you think they're in the pragmatics, like I do, then you think people either reason with them or reason about them or both, they better hook up to something psychologically real, something that can be in the pragmatics. And in particular, as you'll see, I'm obsessed with the simplest of discourses. I'm only going to think of discourse reference introduced here by indefinite descriptions. Those are, first of all, the classic kind of discourse reference in the literature. But also, I think, and we'll go through an example in a moment, so that the very most ordinary, simple discourses, like a man walked in, he sat down, present problems that are not sufficiently not sufficiently noticed in the literature. I think a lot of people have the tendency, as soon as they try to do anything with anaphora or discourse references mental files, immediately go to the difficult cases where the indefinite's embedded somewhere. In fact, if you look at, say, like Paul Elburn's entire book, Situations and Individuals, he never treats a discourse like a man walked in, he sat down. And I think these present, and people assume they won't present problems, but I think they do. I was interested in questions like, which is one of the things I'll address in this talk, if discourse reference are mental files, are they the same sorts of mental files as those involved in singular thought, or are they files with some sort of derived functions? And this connects sort of directly to some of the descriptions in the brief of this conference. And finally, the question that I'm going to take up in the second half of the talk that's really the focus here, the first half I'll give you some background of my view, arguments in favor of identifying discourse reference with mental files. And in the second half, I'm going to consider whether deploying a mental file in thought requires content of the form of a singular thought. Right? So if we think of discourse reference as mental files, that is, when we think through discourse reference in a conversation, we're deploying a mental file. Does that mean we have singular thoughts about the object under discussion in a discourse? Okay. So let me start with this quotation from Haim, just for sort of illustrative purposes, what I think some of the mysteries in the literature are. So she writes that Karchinen takes care to distinguish discourse reference from the actual cats and cars and fish that happen to fit the descriptions on file cards. Discourse reference are supposed to be of a more abstract nature than that. I certainly agree that discourse reference must not be confused with the things the file cards describe, but I see no reason to distinguish them from the file cards. Rather, I find that identifying them with file cards does away with questions as to their ontological status that are at best uninteresting and at worst confusing. So first of all, some of this quotation might, in the description of this conference, I think Francois points out that discourse files or discourse reference are sometimes used to, sometimes discourse reference is identified with the file and sometimes it's identified with the object of that file, and this might be part of the source, I think, of that confusion. Second of all, it's not clear to me that identifying them with files does away with questions as to their ontological status. It just pushes the question back of what does it mean to identify them with files. What's worse is if you put this in the context of Haim's own view, she goes on to say that the file card metaphor is just that, a metaphor, and a theoretical concept in her system. So you might still think there are very much open questions, even going all the way back here, that I think have yet to be solved, on what is the ontological status of a file card, if we don't want to take the file card metaphor just metaphorically, or as a mere theoretical concept. Okay. So here's some of the main points I'm going to argue for in this talk. I think discourse reference should be identified most literally with mental files. That is, I'm going to argue that there's good reason to think they are a type of mental file. And that these mental files, the discourse files, are very close to the paradigmatic mental files in singular thought, playing a similar functional roles in cognition. I'll get to that argument in a moment. I'm going to argue that public shared discourse reference in the conversational context can be derived from the individual mental files. And finally, going back to that question about pseudo-singular thought and talk, that deploying a mental file in thought is compatible with partially descriptive content of the thought. I'm going to argue that thinking and speaking with discourse reference involves pseudo-singular thought and talk. Okay, on to the argument. And I'm going to start with just some challenges for thinking of discourse reference as mental files. Okay. And I want to start by just going through this example. So as I said, I was going to be focused on the simplest of cases. This is going to be the discourse that goes throughout this talk. We have a discourse like, one, a student came to Fred's office hours today. She asked questions about the midterm. I assume most people in this room are familiar with the basics of discourse reference and dynamic semantics or dynamic pragmatics, given the theme of this conference, but right, sort of glossing over the difference between different implementations. We have that 1A introduces a new discourse referent, let's say 1, and on it we add the predicates, is a student, came to Fred's office hours on March 30th, 2026, And then 1B picks up on that very same discourse reference, and we have that one ask questions about the midterm. I realize I forgot to say one thing that I wanted to say earlier. I maybe can make this clear at the end as well, but I'm not in this talk going to argue for any kind of particular formal implementation. That's not what I'm up to. What I'm up to is, when I talk about grounding the notion of a discourse referent, what I'm interested in is the interpretation of that formal implementation, how that formal implementation hooks up to human communication and human cognition. So what you're not going to see is a particular formal implementation. Although I'm going to say some things about how I think it works. All right, sorry. So the first challenge for a mental files framework is that a student in 1A is not a referring term of any kind, let alone a singular term. So if you think of the traditional mental files in philosophy as being intimately connected with singular thought, then immediately there's a question: if a student came to Fred's office hours today, is supposed to introduce a discourse referent, but a student is not even a referring term of any kind, how do we get anything that looks like a singular, like a mental file from singular thought there? It doesn't seem to put conversational participants into the right kind of contact with a referent in the world, right? The way maybe a name or a demonstrative or a perceptual connection might put you into contact with a referent. Okay. Right, so as I've already said, insofar as we think of mental files as intimately related with singular thought, how do we reconcile this with what seems like very good reasons for thinking that this whole discourse has, in general descriptive truth conditions? It's not about a particular student, at least at the level of the discourse. This is not a new problem. I don't mean that I'm the first person who's ever thought of this problem. In fact, this is the kind of tension that's very much resolved in Hans's work in DRT, that you have the discourse reference in the DRS, and then you get the existential truth conditions from the embedding. This is just to point out a challenge for grounding the notion. Okay. The next thing, sort of in line with that, it's important, I think, the way I see things, and the way lots of people see things, as you can see from the citations here, is that truth conditions of discourses like one are independent of who the speaker has in mind or who the speaker might be referring to. So it's true that the speaker often has to have a particular individual in mind when they assert something like, a student came to Fred's office hours today, and I'll show further evidence later about this kind of specificity. But this object, it's well established that this object doesn't enter into the truth conditions of a student came to Fred's office today. So for example, if my colleague says that to me and has a particular student, let's say Elaine, in mind, but they're just wrong, but it happens to be the case that a different student, right, say Mary, came to Fred's office hours, what they said was true, despite them not, they said a true thing for the wrong reasons. Something that's less noted, but certainly by no means not noted, this is something that's captured, for example, by dynamic semantic theories, is that this is also true of the sentence containing definite expressions anaphoric on the indefinite, like anaphoric definite descriptions or anaphoric pronouns. It doesn't matter that we go on and use something that sounds like definite reference by saying she asked questions about the midterm. The same thing holds if the speaker has Elaine in mind the whole time, but Elaine never came to Fred's office hours that day. In fact, it was Mary who came to Fred's office hours and asked questions about the midterm. People share the intuition that what the speaker said was true. Okay. So just to expand on this a little bit more, this kind of discourse seems to be compatible with multiple witnesses, that is, objects in the world that satisfy the various conditions put on the discourse referent. More evidence that this is compatible with multiple witnesses is that it's completely felicitous to follow it up with things like 3C or 3C prime. In fact, she was one of many students to come to Fred's office hours with questions about the midterm. Or in fact, she was one of many students to come to Fred's office hours, though she was the only one to ask questions about the midterm, which shows there's no kind of homogeneity requirement either if there are multiple witnesses. Furthermore, we can get these kinds of discourses where the speaker has no specific object in mind at all. So here's a case where I'm imagining that on purely statistical grounds, we know that a dog is kidnapped about every few minutes in our neighborhood, and we imagine, you know, we're at like the neighborhood watch meeting trying to stop this rash of dog nappings. And I say, as the speaker, in the last 5 minutes, a dog was kidnapped. The owners are probably frantically searching for him. He's scared. Let's go save the dog. Okay. And in this case, and you can come up with other cases like this, in this case, I have no dog in mind. It is purely on statistical grounds that I utter this kind of discourse. And yet, it doesn't need to be, you know, I can say in the last 5 minutes, a dog was kidnapped. He's scared. It doesn't require any kind of like modal operators or anything like that. I can speak completely straightforwardly. Okay, so just to summarize, a discourse referent then is like an address that stores information that hangs together according to the discourse. We can think of the discourse reference structured as identified with a numerical index and being annotated with associated predicates or conditions. Sometimes I'm really sloppy and I say discourse referent to mean the whole annotated thing, and sometimes I use it to just mean the index, and I apologize in advance for doing that. Just quoting from Cartunen, it justifies the occurrence of a coreferential pronoun or a definite noun phrase later in the text. And as I've been arguing, it's not to be identified with any particular referent, because these kinds of discourses in the existence of a discourse referent that we're tracking throughout the discourse seems to work the same whether there's a single witness for it, like one student, no witnesses, right? Then what we say is not true, but the discourse works the same. Or if the discourse was about a unicorn, it would work exactly the same. Or, as I've tried to say, multiple witnesses. Okay. That's going to be the main challenge I take up in the talk, but I will say a little bit about this second challenge. And that is that mental files, sort of by definition, live in private cognition. But on many, many views of discourse, and context and discourse dynamics, discourse reference are employed as devices in a shared conversational context. So Haim has them in something like the Common Ground. I certainly think of them as something that is shared, that people use as shared resources in the course of interpretation and tracking information of a discourse. We see it in like work from like Adrian Brazovonu and many other people. And so the second challenge is this. If we want to think of discourse reference as mental files, is there a sense in which private mental files and cognition can ground the notion of this public shared thing in something like that's public and common that we can employ in the context of interpretation in a discourse? Can you just tell me how I'm doing on time? Because I actually can't see my clock the way my computer is.
You have got about 25 minutes left.
Beautiful. Okay. I just thought I'd have a clock, and I have like no sense of where time is going. Okay. Great. Okay. So this part is called discourse reference. Should we call it discourse reference as mental files? Typo right there in the title of the section, is based on a paper of that title in which I argue that discourse reference and mental files should be identified. And I make this argument by arguing that they have the same kinds of functional roles. And if we think of them as defined internalistically by their role in cognition, then this gives us really good reason to identify discourse reference with mental files. So let me go through what I take those roles to be. I'm going to put them quickly up now, and then I'm going to go through each one slowly. I don't mean to say these are maybe the only roles that characterize mental files, but I take these to be common ones that we can say characterize mental files in a lot of the literature, in like Francois's work, in Robin Jeschen, in John Perry, and many, many other people who write about mental files. They serve the identity function. The bundling function, I'm going to talk more about each of these, and and I'll talk much more about non-satisfactionality. Okay, so starting with identity. So mental files constitute an agent's individuation and mode of identification of objects, that is, each mental file is supposed to be a repository of information that, by definition, the agent takes to be about a single individual. And one way of seeing this is that mental files are used to explain things like coreferential inner representations, or devices of coreference de jure, by just having a mental file. That's to go back to things like that Ellen said, that's how we re-identify the same object. That is just the job of a mental file, is when you deploy the mental file, there is no question that you're thinking about the same object. Okay. Discourse reference also plays this function, but for the object under discussion in a discourse. So again, here, when I'm thinking about discourse references, mental files, I really want to distinguish them from any kind of other private mental files we might have associated with what's going on in the discourse. So for example, if I'm the speaker of 1A and I say a student came to Fred's office hours today, I might have a very robust mental file of the student who I have in mind. But that's not what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about is, well, what I'm arguing there is a mental file associated just with the discourse information. Okay. And so if we think of the role of discourse reference, following the objects under discussion, they play this role of identity, right? A discourse reference is just a repository of information that an agent takes to be about a single object according to the discourse. Once you've identified something as being an update of the same discourse reference, there's no question of whether we're talking about the same object under discussion. That's just what it is to be about the same discourse reference. Okay, I've already said this. Oh wait, I haven't said, they're devices of de jure coreference, but this has to be understood when it comes to discourse reference in a weak sense, because discourse reference, as I've tried to argue, don't necessarily refer. And so they require not coreference, but really co-instantiation, or what Jim Pryor calls co-designation. And competence with the discourse alone guarantees co-instantiation. Like, once we've resolved the pronoun to the correct discourse referent, if you don't, you know, understand that the same student who came to Fred's office is also the one who asked questions about the midterm, you've just fundamentally misunderstood the discourse. Okay, bundling. Mental files serve as vehicles for storing clusters of information together associated with an index or mental label that provides an economical and efficient means of sorting, retrieving, and adding information on a particular individual. And discourse reference are just sort of by definition things that serve the same role, right? They're conceived as addresses or pegs at which we compile information that hangs together according to the discourse. Is a student came to Fred's office hours, asked questions about the midterm. Here's where I want to slow down a bit, because I think this is going to be really important. Mental files are by many, this is not agreed on by everybody in the literature, but sort of I take the basic fundamental mental files to be vehicles of singular thought. And following Rachel Goodman and her co-authors, we can characterize singular thought as thinking in a non-satisfactional manner, which Goodman defines as thinking of a particular object, but not merely as the possessor of certain properties. And I want to say more about this, but I'll first say more about it by saying what it's not. So it does not the requirement of object-dependent thought. The way to characterize singular thought in terms of non-satisfactional thinking is to distinguish that from the more robust condition that it has to be thought that depends on an object. And this is to allow that we can have singular thoughts about, say, non-existent entities, right? So about, say, Santa Claus or something like that, because you might have a lot of people think there are good reasons for thinking that are sort of conceptual and cognitive and epistemic ways of thinking about non-existent objects are very similar to the way we think, have singular thoughts about existent objects. It is also not the same as Bach's distinction between satisfactional and relational thinking, because relational thinking requires that we have some sort of relation, like an acquaintance relation, with an object in the world. It's close to it, but it's not quite that. This, for example, allows that we can have singular thought through, say, reference-fixing descriptions. It's about a way of thinking rather than a reference determining relation or a particular type of content. It's a way of thinking about, it's really hard to put into words because even she talks about it as thinking of a particular object and then immediately goes on to explain it as, well, there doesn't have to be an object. And so it's very hard to actually, I was trying to think of a neutral definition and couldn't come up with one. But it's a way of thinking about a particular kind of object, content, like an object or an object-like thing that's maybe not an object. It's a way of thinking of it not merely as the possessor, not via certain descriptions, but it via some independent way, where, say, all the properties associated with it are revisable. Okay. And what I want to argue now is that discourse reference also play the role of non-satisfactional modes of thought. And I think this is actually really important to the way discourse reference work, and it's underappreciated. Okay. So I've already argued that there's no specific object that's the referent of the discourse referent. Like, there's no specific student that the discourse is about. The discourse proceeds as though there's a specific, particular object under discussion. Okay. And I want to say that we can think of this as a certain pseudo-singular mode of thought. Okay. This is a non-satisfactional way of thinking, but at the same time, it's sort of by definition not aimed at a particular referent ever. Okay. That's what I think makes it pseudo-singular, as opposed to, I mean, I don't care what label we apply to the cases where we're thinking of fictional objects, but there's a sense in which thinking about the fictional objects like Santa Claus, we can think of parasitic on our normal uses of names and thinking about objects. Here, I think that when we're thinking about discourse reference, they're just not the sort of things, at least the ones that are introduced by indefinites. Again, that's what I'm worried about. They're just not the sort of things that are aimed at a particular referent in the world. Okay, so I want to argue for that a little bit more. This is first using an example from Van Roy, that we have a sort of specificity here that's surprising. This is why Van Roy brings up the example. It's surprising if you think the truth conditions are just existential. And he actually brings this up as an objection to a lot of dynamic semantic views, whereas if you think of, say, how anaphora across discourse is working, it's just by a dynamic existential quantifier that has open scope to the right. The fact that this is horrible is kind of surprising. So the background for this example, because you can also make it sound good, but you're thinking of the background that makes it sound good. The background to this example is that we all know that two men called John yesterday. One called him in the morning, one called him in the afternoon. That has to be in the common ground, otherwise we can come up with a great interpretation for the example. C is supposed to be bad. Right, so John says, a man called me up yesterday. Mary asks, did he have a gravel voice? And he says, that depends. If he called in the morning, he did, but if he called in the afternoon, he did not. The only way to hear that as good is if you're talking about one guy and he has like a gravel voice when he calls people in the morning, but he doesn't have a gravel voice when he calls people in the afternoon. That's fine. But on the interpretation Van Roy is going for, the background is we all know there's one man who called in the morning and a different man who called in the afternoon. And he says 5C is just uninterpretable that way. But that's surprising if we just have existential truth conditions, right? I already argued that these kinds of discourses are compatible with multiple witnesses. So it seems that when we introduce something like a discourse referent, we're immediately proceeding through the discourse as though there is a specific single referent under discussion. Okay. Moving from specificity to non-satisfactional thinking, I think we can argue from pronominal contradiction cases that pretty much all the descriptions can be stripped away, and we still maintain thinking through the same discourse referent, which seems to make it think that we're not thinking of the object under discussion through any specific descriptions. So this is Strawson's exact example. A man fell over the edge, and B can say, he didn't fall, he jumped. And then C could say, it wasn't a man, it was a woman wearing trousers. That is Strawson's original example. Just put that on the record and for the film. I think women can wear trousers and not be mistaken. No. If you think if you think that something weird is happening when we switch from he to it, note that at least in English as it is spoken in the States, we now use singular they all the time, and you can nicely do a revised version of Strawson's discourse that does not change the pronoun at all. So you can say a man fell over the edge, and B says they didn't fall, they jumped, and they were a woman, not a man. And having they as the singular gender neutral pronoun there, it's totally fine. Okay. Furthermore, I've argued in previous work that we can have pronominal contradiction without there being any speaker reference. So a lot of people look at those pronominal contradiction cases and they say, no, we don't learn anything about discourse reference from those cases. All we learn is that sometimes pronouns target who the speaker has in mind. What we're doing there is just targeting speaker reference. I don't think that's right. So here come the statistical cases again. So suppose we know purely on statistical grounds that approximately once a week, but not every week, just on average, or we think we know on statistical grounds that on average a man jumps off a certain bridge at least once a week. So this is not based on having any particular man in mind. And I think it's Haim who has a similar example to this. Note that you also can get a particular man in mind per occasion on this example, because we have a very general usually and only statistical grounds for it. Okay. I also have a, not here, but I have a modal case as well where you just really can't have a man in mind. So we can say, usually a man jumps off this bridge at least once a week, and B says, no, he's almost always pushed. And C says, and it's almost always a woman. Okay. So again, even when there seems to be no possibility of speaker reference, we have this evidence of non-satisfactional thinking. Okay, that's the end of that part of the argument. That's going to be mostly what I want to bring up in the final part of the talk, but before I get to the final part of the talk, a short interlude on that second question that I'm not going to focus on today, but do want to say something about, which is how we get from private files in cognition to that public shared file in the context. And here's how I think it works. So from thought to context, if all goes well in a discourse, the individual mental files that are tracking discourse reference are coordinated among the conversational participants. That is, we all have our internal mental file that has, like, is a student, went to Fred's office hours today, asked questions about the midterm. And these mental files are in some sense public because the information on them is just the information that every conversational participant has access to, and every conversational participant in principle, if they have anything to add, can add to them. So this is where I wanted to say again that this is separate from the private mental files that we may be generating over the course of a conversation. I may have all sorts of thoughts about this so-called student who came to Fred's office hours, but that's not what the discourse referent is tracking. Okay. We have just public information on that. And our coordinated individual files are related by coreference de jure in the weak sense that I outlined before, that they have to co-refer if they refer at all. And uniqueness is not required, they just have to be co-instantiated. That is, the same witness has to satisfy both files, meaning that if there's, say, multiple students who came to Fred's office hours today and asked questions about the midterm in the real world, there's a sense of understanding that, say, both Elaine and Mary came to Fred's office hours today and asked questions about the midterm. My file can't be instantiated to Mary, whereas yours is satisfied by Elaine. We wouldn't somehow be talking about the same thing. Okay. And so I think here the public file in the context as derived from the individual mental files, it's in this sense intersubjective. We can think of it as a collection of or an abstraction from the coordinated individual mental files of the conversational participants. And that's all I'm going to say about that, but I wanted to get that in our common ground as background to my view. I want to go back to the original question that I wanted to focus on in this talk about the relationship, like what is it to have a pseudo-singular thought? How does that relate to having a singular thought? If we want to take seriously the idea that discourse reference are identified with mental files. Sorry, I'm going to ask for a time check again.
10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. We can do this. Okay. On the sort of view I'm proposing, Discourse reference amount to a way of cognizing content rather than a specific kind of content. So this goes back to that earlier question from that quotation from Haim, you know, about whether discourse reference are a part of the content or merely a part of the file management system. And I want to say they're merely part of the file management system. They're sort of a way we think about what's under discussion, that we think about it in this identity, bundling, and non-satisfactional manner, but they don't give us a particular kind of content. I just said this. Okay. The tension is that truth conditions for discourses like number one seem to be existential. That's what I spent a while arguing. There's no single specific referent. And as I've said, our thoughts deploy mental files, but they're not about mental files. It's a way of organizing information and thought rather than the object of thoughts. The content of our thoughts, then, what seems to be left is that it has to be characterized by the existential truth conditions. Okay? And then we seem to have this kind of mismatch, right? We have the existential truth conditions that seem to be the contents of our thoughts, and we have these like singular like vehicles of thought that we're deploying at the same time. And the question is, how do we reconcile those two things? Well, that's what at least we've been left with, given the arguments I've made. Okay. Right. Oh, I have more to say about this. I just forgot everything I put in the slides. At the same time, right, I've argued that there's a significant element of non-satisfactional thinking here, right? That discourse reference track the objects under discussion in a non-satisfactional way. And we can think, sorry, of a contrast with discourses like one or more students came to Fred's office hours today. We can't follow that up with she asked questions about the midterm. But for all I've said, those are truth conditionally equivalent, but a difference in the way we're thinking about things. So, sorry. I want to distinguish between two kinds of things going on in the discourse. The discourse number one, a student came to Fred's office hours today, she has questions about the midterm. One, I want to say that I this is just how, now I'm putting assumptions out there, I treat indefinites as ordinary existential quantifiers. This partly goes to the background of adopting a very straightforward truth conditional static semantics and having all the dynamics in the context. What I want to say here is that the sentence containing the indefinite description triggers the introduction of the mental file, making it available for future anaphoric reference. But there's nothing about the thought itself that I want to say is like singular thought. Okay. And I have a whole account of how this happens. Right. Why does this happen? One answer that's not mine is that it's just part of the meaning of indefinites, right? Indefinites encode a rule that tells you start a new discourse referent, which now we can interpret as start a new mental file. I'm not going to argue against that here, but we could just say that and go on. Another answer, this one's mine, is that the same cognitive mechanisms we use for tracking objects in visual perception and in singular thought are used to track objects under discussion in a discourse, even when we have no connection to a specific referent. We just act as though there is. And whether a new mental file is started, an old one updated, or nothing is done at all is dependent on pragmatic reasoning. Okay. I'm running low on time, so I'm going to start. I'm running low. 5 minutes. Okay. Okay, I talk about this a lot in written work, so we can. I talk about how the reasoning works in written work. I just want to point out that there's some empirical work that seems to lend support to the idea that truth conditionally equivalent sentences can trigger different kinds of representations, like object file versus ensemble representations. So that lends some like empirical support to this kind of hypothesis that we could have a difference in the mental file representation between these two. But I can talk more about that in the Q&A if we want. What I want to get to is the actual pseudo-singular thought. Okay. here's my actual, I said that we're going to be an implementation, and you won't see my formal implementation in this talk because there wasn't enough time, but I will tell you a little bit about how I'm thinking about what the truth conditional content looks like, and then show how that interacts with the mental files, or the discourse references mental files. So I defend an E-type account of pronouns. On this view, pronouns go proxy for definite descriptions. I defend a particular type of this account, an existentialist account. That is to say, definite descriptions have existentially quantified content, and they differ from indefinites only in their presuppositional profile. So as we can see in 12, she sat down for E-type reasons, that goes proxy for some definite description, which one I'll say in a moment, becomes the F sat down. Because this is an existentialist account, we're going to get that's going to be equivalent to un F sat down with particular presuppositional profile that I'll talk about in a moment. We've got to get a few more things on the table for me to be able to tell you what I think. Quantifiers, as we all know, are often supplemented with covert material that restricts their domains. So when we have, for example, definite descriptions, very often they're incomplete. And one common way of thinking of that is that there's covert material that makes them complete descriptions. So the combination of overt predicate, if there is any, with covert material is the complete restrictor, and we can call the property it expresses the restrictor property. Okay. Some restrictor properties have singleton extensions, called these singleton restrictors, meaning there's only one thing in the extension. These are the ones that we're going to have for sort of traditional non-anaphoric definite descriptions. Also, this is from Hawthorne and Manley, one kind of singleton restrictor is what they call a singular restrictor, where the restrictor property involves some singular way of thinking about an object, such as the property of being identical to Madeline. Okay, so we can get in our sort of quantificational account of definite descriptions this singular restrictor. In previous work, I argued that anaphoric definite descriptions and pronouns, in addition to being restricted in ways I'm about to describe, are pragmatically restricted by pseudo-singular restrictors, where that property is something like being identical to one, where one is the index on the relevant discourse referent. And just like the singular restrictor, here's what I want to say, just like the singular restrictor in a child who's identical to Madeline is happy, involves the deployment of the Madeline mental file, though it expresses existential content, so does the pseudo-singular restrictor in a student who's identical to one sat down involve the deployment of the one mental file. But of course, it's merely pseudo-singular because the discourse referent doesn't even aim to refer, on my view. Time?
1 minute.
I can do it. Well, not in 1 minute, but I can be close. Here's the account informally. I also have a formal account of anaphoric definite descriptions. And remember, pronouns just are definite descriptions with no overt material that I give in my 2022 paper. I say that an anaphoric definite description, the F, presupposes discourse uniqueness. That is, that there's exactly one accessible discourse referent in the context that the material is F associated with it. The semantic content is existential, that there's at least one F. If the presupposition is satisfied, a sentence of the form the F is G is true, if and only if there's at least one F that is G, and the sentence has no truth value if the presupposition is not satisfied. Discourse reference come in, I have them in the context, to play two roles in domain restriction. One, the descriptive material for the domain restriction is supplied by all the information contained in the file. This is in the semantics. So that is to say, where, you know, I said pronouns go proxy for definite descriptions. What description? The description is all the information on the discourse file. Formally, I employ that in a Stanley and Szabo style of domain restriction, where the discourse referent goes in for the individual, and the function retrieves all the information. Second, they act in the pragmatics as well. They add the pseudo-singular restrictor property being identical to I, where I is the index of the discourse referent. So let's just have an application to our example. If we have the first sentence, a student came to Fred's office hours today, that triggers the new discourse referent, one, for the pragmatic reasons on the slide I skipped. With the information is a student came to Fred's office hours. Now we have she asked questions about the midterm. When it's resolved to one, it provides the restrictor properties is a student came to Fred's office hours on March 30th, 2026 to the semantics, and the restrictor property is identical to one to the pragmatics. And then we get this as the final truth conditions. A student who came to Fred's office hours on March 30th, 2026, who's identical to one, asked questions about the midterm. Now note there can be multiple witnesses for all the properties associated with the discourse referent. So when it comes to anaphoric pronouns and definite descriptions, we do not get a singleton restrictor. These are purely and genuinely existential truth conditions that are compatible with there being multiple students who came to Fred's office hours on March 30th, or multiple students who came to Fred's office hours on March 30th and asked questions about the midterm. At the same time, we get this pseudo-singular restrictor at the level of pragmatics that constrains the way we interpret it, that we're thinking about this as a single individual in terms of identity, bundling, and non-satisfactionality. That is to say, the tension is right there, that even though we have existential truth conditions, it's wrapped in this pseudo-singular restrictor that makes us think we could strip away any of those properties if we wanted to by contradicting it in the next sentence. So, and this is my last slide. Here are two potential ways forward. I don't mean this list to be exhaustive, but here are some thoughts for what we could think if everything I've said is right. Maybe following some suggestions, just suggestions, they don't commit themselves to this view, in Hawthorne and Manley, we could posit that there just is no singular term or referential terms in language, they're only in thought. Okay. On this kind of view, thoughts of the form, Madeline is happy, and then thoughts based on anaphoric pronouns on indefinite descriptions, like she is happy when she is happy is dependent on a girl is in the cafe, are just related to the same form of linguistic content. They're both just restricted quantifiers, and there's just no difference in the form. That's one view we could take, but none of it has sort of like the standard form of singular thought that we thought there was out there with connected to referential terms. Another way, and the way I'm more tempted to go, is thinking with mental files can be related to different kinds of content, so long as the content essentially deploys the file. So thinking Madeline is happy is just a thought of a different form from she is happy in the anaphoric case, the latter containing descriptive information in a way the former does not, but both involve deploying a mental file that involves thinking about the object in a non-satisfactional way. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, questions? Wait for the microphone to come round. I'm not going to keep a specific list, because I'll try and move around, but show me now if you're interested in asking a question. But if you think of a question later, then just put your hand up later. There's no need to think that you've got a question now in order to get in the question session. If it comes to you later, I'll try and get to some of the people who only think of a question later. But let me start at the back there.
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
I think this is basically a continuation of the question I asked you the last time you presented this material.
Yeah.
So is there a reason why you don't want to say these sentences prompt two thoughts, one that is just the existential interpretation, and then also you get this second singular thought, the mental file thing, and people just have that as it's triggered in the way that you said. And if you ask them to talk about whether the sentence is true or false, they'll focus on the existential vehicle, but the singular thing is there just for pragmatic purposes. Is there a reason why you're not wanting that view?
Yeah, there is a reason. And also I want to say I hope that you saw a lot of what got extended in this talk was in response to some of the questions that you raised last time we discussed this material. So there's a few reasons why that's a very nice view. There's a few reasons I don't want to go that way. Here's at least two. One, is that, I mean, maybe this could be captured in two thoughts, but there's something about this tension that I think is at the very heart of discourse reference, and I really believe this, that somehow we're thinking of the thing descriptively and non-descriptively at the same time. Because something really important about discourse reference is tracking the descriptions. In some sense, that's all we have, right? A student walked in, she sat down. We're just given a bunch of descriptions about the world. I don't think it connects us properly to a particular referent. On the other hand, there's sort of lots of evidence that we're really thinking about this in this singular or pseudo-singular way. And so I think putting those things together just captures, I think, what the thought is like to think about these things. That doesn't mean we couldn't capture it another way, but that's why I go this way. The more, you know, technical reason to go this way is you actually really need the pseudo-singular restrictors when you're an existentialist once you have more than one discourse referent in the discourse. So, for example, if I say a student waved at a professor, or a student talked to a professor, she waved goodbye to her. Okay. Or let me resolve it in a way. Or a man talked to a woman, he waved goodbye to her. Right? No, I needed the first case. Sorry, I got confused. I needed them to be interchangeable. Right? And say we resolve that in context in a particular way. All we're going to get on the existentialist view for the second sentence, like she waved goodbye to her, is that there's at least one student who waved goodbye to at least one professor, who was talking to a professor and waved goodbye to at least one professor. And you can come up with situations in which you can satisfy the first... I need to think of a particular case. There's ways in which you can satisfy that in a model, if you don't have continuity, in which that's true, even though they're not the same as the professor and student from the first sentence. Okay, and that would be pretty bad on a theory of discourse reference. So if we had just the existential content kept completely separate from the pseudo-singular content, we don't get this tracking across discourses. That doesn't turn out to be a problem if we only ever have one discourse referent or a discourse reference like don't interact with each other or anything like that. But as soon as we have discourse reference interacting with each other, it's very easy to come up with models in which we can satisfy all the existentials, but we've lost continuity of instantiation. And so the pseudo-singular restrictors being a way to, for the conversational participants to cognize the discourse ensures that those models are ruled out.
Let's go to Ellen on the end.
Well, my question was pretty similar, so, and thank you for a wonderful talk. It was just great. But maybe a different way to put it is just, do we need to say that let's say we mentally represent the truth conditions in some way, which makes sense to me, but do we want to make that equivalent to thought, which is what it seemed like. So you're pointing out now that we need the truth conditions to be able to track reference somehow, but like, does it entail saying that that's a thought representation, or is there some way of separating levels there between the truth conditions and the linguistic truth conditions and the thought?
Right, so what I said could be an answer to why we need the pseudo-singular restrictors and the truth conditions, but sort of not an answer to why we can't also have a separate thought. Good, I see the question now. Yeah, that is a good question.
Part of the problem that we're using thought for too many things and you
want to
separate
out. Well, I think there's we have in one sense I want to say, I mean, we could have lots of thoughts and we could also have like singular thoughts at the same time. But what I want to track is the thought that's about the content of this discourse, right? That's the thought I'm interested in. And perhaps it's not that I'm dead set against it. I'm sympathetic to it if I can see exactly how it would work out. but it's not clear to me what thought we're having about this discourse that doesn't somehow involve like the propositions expressed by the sentences in the discourse, at least according to my view. Of course, we can have a totally different view about what the sentences express, and then we'd have a different view, right? So I mean, lots of people here think maybe more deeply about concepts and thoughts than I do and can tell me exactly what that would be, but it would seem to me that to have a thought about the discourse content is, at least in large part, to grasp the propositions being expressed, and that is what I was going for. If there's like another layer of thought on top of that, I have no in principle argument against it. And if someone could explain to me exactly how that works, how those connect, and if that's, you know, maybe there's like, we just talk about the, you know, something like Hans Comte's work, if there's like a level of mental representation that then leads to truth conditions, that's just not the sort of framework that I was working in. But if we can think of sort of independently what it means to both have a thought about the propositional content and then separately have this like second layer of thought, then I would be open to exploring that. I don't have like a big in principle reason why not, but just that's just to explain what I thought I was doing.
Right, so Gabor.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So I've been thinking about, I definitely don't have the math to... Let's try it again. I don't have the math to think it through, but I feel like this account sort of should interact with specific indefinites and the type of ambiguity that you have in cases like if a rich relative of mine dies, yeah. I will inherit. Can you help me walk through how you think about those cases, or it's not? Yeah.
No, I can give you some answer, but not like I don't have a work through case of like if a rich relative of mine died, then right, and the two different, like off the top of my head, I can't do the two different readings. But this certainly has the tools, like this kind of account has the tools to account for those cases. And they're not even really my tools. They're like the tools that already exist out there that I'm borrowing. And in the case of specific indefinites, we would, I think, have a singleton restrictor to a specific referent. Right, and like the two ways of seeing this is either we have a discourse referent that in this case is anchored to a referent. I'm not against there being discourse referents that are anchored to reference, just to be clear. The puzzle I wanted to deal with was the non-specific indefinites that seem to lead to co-reference in a discourse. It's not that I don't think there's also discourse reference introduced by names or specific indefinites. But I think the way to treat those cases is just, but I think that's how Roger Schwarzschild treats those cases, by using singleton restrictors, so it's not sort of my tools, but it would mesh nicely with the system, I think.
François.
This is actually a follow-up to your discussion with Kyle and Helen. I think it's not so much the notion of thought that has to be duplicated, but it's rather the notion of content, because you sort of presuppose, we already talked about that,
yep.
Presuppose the uniqueness of content, so there is one content that actually corresponds to the truth conditions. But it's, I mean, many people have suggested, and you yourself said that maybe that's part of the sort of framework associated with Hans, suggested that when we, in the case of discourse interpretation, so there is a certain state of affairs that corresponds to the truth conditions, but we sort of build a mental model of that in the course of understanding the utterance. And the mental model we build, it provides a second level of content, this more cognitive sort of notion of content. And it might be that the linguistic resources we use depend on precisely that notion of content. So it's quite possible that actually there is this, as you say, existential content for our utterance, but our mental model involves a particular witness, an imaginary witness, for that existential content. And that's because there is this individual, imaginary individual in the mental model that we can deploy sort of the resources of singular thought for thinking about and talking about that individual, even though in the end, the content, the actual content at the level of truth conditions is simply existential.
Yeah, good. So I I had some thoughts about this in the talk. I kept deleting the slides because I wasn't sure what I wanted to say. And so unsure of what I wanted to say that at certain points I had the thought that what I've said here resists the move to fictional files, to thinking of discourse reference at fictional files. And at other times I had the complete opposite, that this is a move towards thinking of discourse reference as fictional files. So I guess part of my answer to this question is I don't know what I think yet. I want to say something else, but that's just a sort of background that I'm very sympathetic to this. And I think at a certain point I thought we can sort of resist the move to thinking that they're fictional files, because here I've just said, look, all we have are sort of files in the public context, and we have files as they're deployed in the propositional content, and that we don't have to think of these sort of like, they're not imaginary in any sense. On the other hand, they still do seem to still be imaginary because they have this pseudo aspect to it where we're acting as though there's a witness, and maybe that's best understood in terms of a mental model. So background is, I don't know. Maybe the other thing, and I don't have a particular reason at this moment for not accepting that. I want to say a little bit more about the framework or what I was trying to do. If we think of discourse reference as important elements of the context that help us communicate and interpret each other, then what I ultimately wanted to say something about is how discourse reference can be part of a public shared context and how we can employ them in the course of communication and interpretation. And having said all that, that's completely compatible with their, very compatible, in fact, as we know, with their being sort of individual mental models. But I wanted to say something more about how we can get away from, out of the individual mental models and into something public, like a common ground, but for discourse reference. And so that was the project.
Isn't that author Renaud? Isn't that author Renaud, this issue of private versus...
Sorry, it's very staticky. It's hard to...
This issue of private versus intersubjective is sort of orthogonal to the issue of whether there is this mental model or fictional aspect, because it might work at the intersubjective level as well as at the individual level.
So you're thinking that there could be a mental model, and then we get the intersubjective discourse referent from the mental model, but then I want to know how that hooks up with communication, right? And so if we think what I'm communicating is something like the semantic content of the sentences, like either we think that semantic content has to match up with whatever the content of the mental model is, which sounds like it, if it's, you don't think it does, sorry. He's like shaking his, I would think that, we want to hook that up to what we're communicating by then using language. And I had thought, perhaps falsely, that the best way to hook that up was to say that the contents of our thoughts were just the contents of what we're communicating with each other. But I am completely open to being told that I was completely naive in that and that I should have done something more complex.
I think you might have to drill down into that with François later, because there's quite a lot of questions left.
Okay.
So,
yes.
Let's move to the next one.
That's why I'm here.
Rory.
Now this relates.
Sorry, Hans will come to you next, but we've got one behind you, and then just wait for the microphone.
Hi. Thank you. Can you hear me through the microphone?
Yes.
I think this idea of the pseudo singularity.
No, we can't hear you. The mic doesn't work.
Hello.
Yeah, that's fine.
The mic is working, right? Okay.
I think so.
Can you hear me, François? Okay. This idea of pseudo-singularity is very fascinating in trying to account for it. I wanted to raise some data that I think is probative into this phenomena, but it's also similarly difficult, I think, to explain. I'd be curious about how you would go about explaining it. And just to kind of riff off of some data that Hans gave earlier, so we started off with the discourse Ponce de Leon believed there was a rejuvenating fountain in Florida, and he wanted to find it. Okay, it seems weird to continue, you know, in fact, it's a normal fountain, it's at the entrance to Disneyland, I don't know.
Yes.
And I assume you could explain this by saying perhaps it picks up on the earlier descriptive thing, like being rejuvenating, so the follow-up is saying there's a non-magical yet somehow rejuvenating of youthful fountain, that's kind of But that, of course, couldn't be the whole story, because with these kind of Strawson situations, it seems like you'd have to say that sometimes different material can go in, because when the speaker responds to the, when the, someone responds to the speaker saying, a man just jumped off the bridge, by saying, no, it was a woman, the speaker, yeah. the response isn't saying, a man who was a woman jumped off the bridge, right? So, and I just wanted to finally add to this something which I think is especially probative, which is a way that you could follow up Hans's example with, and that, which is that, so again, Ponce de Leon believed there was a rejuvenating fountain in Florida. He wanted to find it. He also believed that if it were not a magical fountain, he wouldn't feel the compulsion to find it.
Yeah.
And that seems fine to use it there. So this is just, again, a very complicated range of data, but I think it kind of is probed into this kind of pseudo-singularity.
Yes, good. I love that question. So just to, maybe can I just repeat back to you? I took there to be three kinds of data there. One was the question of why we couldn't, it doesn't seem good to follow it up outside of the context of, was it Ponce de Leon's beliefs, that you can't take back that it's a rejuvenating fountain.
Yes, though in the case, the final case I gave, we're not talking about his original belief world, we're looking at further belief.
Yeah, I got that, yeah. I got that. That's the last case. But the first case was like, we can't just take it back outside of any operator. The last one looks like if you put it within certain kinds of operators, we can take it back. And the middle one was just asking about how I treat regular pronominal contradiction cases. Okay, I've been thinking a lot about these things, except for that last one I'm not sure I'm going to be able to say anything good about. So let me talk about the first two. I wanted to put this actually as part of the talk, and then I wasn't sure what to say, and it was too long anyway. But I actually think, like, full view, expanded view, is that I think there are going to be certain cases where it does matter. The grounds on which a speaker who introduces the discourse reference, the grounds on which they speak, I think is going to actually matter for the kind of discourse file we get, and whether there's a descriptive element to the file that can't be revised. So whether we have some sort of descriptive file that has like a guiding description that cannot be revised. And I think in when the speaker has a particular individual in mind, where we understand that to be the grounds for them speaking, it's not part of what they say, but it's the reason why they say what they say, we can revise everything. I think in most of the statistical cases, we can't, right? It would be really weird in the case with the kidnapped dog if I then followed up by saying, it's not a dog, it's a cat. It doesn't really make that much sense. I think something similar is gonna go on in the intentional identity cases, where we're gonna need to keep some descriptive, or not intentional, but under the scope of a belief operator or something like that, where if it's not, it's clear that they don't have a specific thing in mind, there's going to be key descriptions that can't be revised. And I think some of like Sam's work on intentional identity and mental files can help explain some of that. I think there are going to be cases where we do need descriptive files. And again, descriptive files are still not a completely descriptive way of thinking about things. You can revise certain properties. There's just going to be sort of like one guiding property that you can't revise. So I actually think full way of thinking about it is we're not going to get away with these like bare-bone, completely non-satisfactional files. For all cases. And it's going to be really interesting to see like when exactly you need to introduce descriptive files and when you can have these sort of just bare bones, absolutely like singular thought files. Okay, that was question one. You're looking at me like, don't go to it.
It's not, no, it's yours is the floor, you can choose.
How much time do we have left?
We haven't got long for questions, but you have got time to answer properly.
Okay, the third one I'll say nothing about because I would love to, that's a great example, I'll think more about it. The second one is, I think, problematic for the kind of view. I do have something to say about it. I'm not sure I'm super happy with what I say. I think the pseudo-singular restrictors sort of help us out. I mostly think of the actual how to account for the pronominal contradiction cases as, you know, we can either think of it as along like Stephen Neal's terms, where the description ends up being something like the like so-called man who jumped off the bridge. But the thing that makes it better than just Neil's is that we have the pseudo-singular restrictor guiding us, that it has to be sort of this continuity of thought that we get. And so we can strip things away because the pseudo-singular restrictor keeps us on the same thing. And so even if we get stripped away so that we have no properties left for a while, we can still process the discourse. But that does sort of pragmatically go back on exactly how we recover the definite description in those cases. I do talk about these cases in that like 2022 linguistics and philosophy paper I mentioned, but I'm
I need to think about them more because I'm not 100% satisfied with what I say there.
Right, let's go to Hans.
We have time.
Can you hear me?
Especially if you can keep it short.
It's really a combination of two questions, and the first is a kind of historical question, but perhaps a little more than that. And the second relates very directly to the last question, especially Françoise. So the first question is just, so you made a point of saying that for you, discourse reference and mental files might be identified. And yeah, is it better?
That's better, yeah.
Okay, sorry. And you gave a fairly extensive argument, first talking about Robin Jeschen's ideas and principles about mental files, and then you said something about discourse reference, and it sort of meshed.
Yeah.
And that was the reason for doing that identification. And I was just wondering, this is really just a historical question, the notion of discourse reference that you were referring to in that argument, where in the history of this whole stuff should that be located? Is it Karhtunen? Is it Heim? Is it anywhere else? I would like to bracket myself out, because although discourse reference are always used in presentations of DOD, including mine, there was at some point a choice, one needed some name for what these things were, given what they were doing in the theory. And there was a real debate at the time in Stanford, like John Perry and John Barwise wanting to call these reference markers. And I eventually chose discourse reference as a kind of gesture of honor towards Karhtunen, thinking that what he was after was very much the same thing that DIT was to implement more formally. And he later on agreed to that. But this may not be your notion of discourse reference. You already at the very beginning said that might be possible. But confusion here. But it would really help me to know what that notion of discourse reference is and what role you attribute to it in the history of the field.
Let's start with that question.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much. That's a very good question. So I took myself to be using the notion of discourse reference that cross-cuts a lot of different ways of doing it, the way you do it, the way Karhtunen talks about it, the way Heim talks about it, the way later dynamic semanticists that come after you talk about it. There are, of course, differences in formal implementation, and in the course of differences of formal implementation, there's differences in specific conceptions of what discourses are, whether discourse reference are, whether they can be in the content or just in the context. And you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I think the features I don't think people think sort of about the non-satisfactional thinking, that was sort of me from the evidence, but in terms of discourse reference having the same structure as mental files and playing the role of identity and bundling, it seems to me that that's something that's there in Karhtunen, that's something that's there in your work, that's something that's there in Heim's work, that's something that's there in Adrian Brezhevonu's work, that's something that's there in like Simon Charlo's work. It doesn't matter, you know, who you're talking. So of course there's huge differences in how those things are implemented. But I took myself to be abstracting away from those differences and thinking like, can we ground the notion of a discourse reference, this thing that's in common between all these different people who use discourse reference?
So we are out of time, but maybe you can follow up in the coffee break with the second part of the question.
Do you have a follow-up question to do with the question then?
But we are out of time, so you're going to have to take that later. Sorry. So Hans, we're going to have to break for coffee now. So I'm sorry, you're going to have
we'll take that up
individually,
yes.
The second part half of the question. So we do actually have two coffee breaks this afternoon because we've got two more speakers. And I should say we should be back here at 3:55 for the next talk. But before then, join me in thanking Karen.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.